friends," Lancel said softly. "I have been expecting him." The sparrows moved aside. Lancel looked even thinner than he had at King's Landing. He was barefoot and dressed in a plain rough-spun tunic of undyed wool that made him look more like a beggar than a lord. The crown of his head had been shaved smooth, but his beard had grown out a little. To call it peach fuzz would have given insult to the peach. It went queerly with the white hair around his ears. "Cousin," said Jamie, when they were alone within the sept, "have you lost your bloody wits?"
"I prefer to say, I've found my faith."
"Where is your father?"
"Gone. We quarreled."
Lancel knelt before the altar of his other father. "Will you pray with me, Jamie?"
"If I pray nicely, will the father give me a new hand?"
"No, but the warrior will give you courage, the smith will lend you strength, and the crone will give you wisdom." "It's a hand I need." The seven gods loomed above carved altars, the dark wood gleaming in the candlelight. A faint smell of incense hung in the air. "You sleep down here?"
"Each night I make my bed beneath a different altar, and the seven send me visions."
Balor the Blessed once had visions too, especially when he was fasting. "How long has it been since you've eaten?"
"My faith is all the nourishment I need."
"Faith is like porridge, better with milk and honey."
"I dreamed that you would come. In the dream you knew what I had done, how I'd sinned. You killed me for it."
"You're more like to kill yourself with all this fasting. Didn't Balor the Blessed fast himself onto a beer?"
"Our lives are candle flames," says the seven-pointed star. "Any errant puff of wind can snuff us out. Death is never far in this world, and seven hells await sinners who do not repent their sins. Pray with me, Jamie."
"If I do, will you eat a bowl of porridge?" When his cuz did not answer, Jamie sighed. "You should be sleeping with your wife, not with the maid. You need a son with Dari blood if you want to keep this castle."
"A pile of cold stones. I never asked for it. I never wanted it. I only wanted—"
Lancel shuddered. "Seven save me, but I wanted to be you." Jamie had to laugh. "Better me than blessed Balor. Dari needs a lion, cuz. So does your little Frey. She gets moist between the legs every time someone mentions Hardstone. If she hasn't bedded him yet, she will soon."
"If she loves him, I wish them joy of one another."
"A lion shouldn't have horns. You took the girl to wife."
"I said some words and gave her a red cloak, but only to please father. Marriage requires consummation.
King Balor was made to wed his sister Dana, but they never lived as man and wife, and he put her aside as soon as he was crowned." "The realm would have been better served if he had closed his eyes and fucked her. I know enough history to know that. In any case, you're not like to be taken for Balor the Blessed."
"No,"
Lancel allowed. "He was a rare spirit, pure and brave and innocent, untouched by all the evils of the world. I am a sinner with much and more to atone for." Jamie put his hand on his cousin's shoulder. "What do you know of sin, cuz?"
"I killed my king."
"The brave man slays with a sword, the craven with a wineskin. We are both kingslayers, sir. Robert was no true king. Some might even say that a stag is a lion's natural prey." Jamie could feel the bones beneath his cousin's skin, and something else as well. Lancel was wearing a hair shirt underneath his tunic. "What else did you do to require so much atonement? Tell me." His cousin bowed his head, tears running down his cheeks. Those tears were all the answer Jamie needed. "You killed the king," he said. "Then you fucked the queen."
"I never—"
"Lay with my sweet sister. Say it. Say it."
"Never spilled my seed in her."
"Cunt," suggested Jamie. "Womb," Lancel finished. "It is not treason unless you finish inside. I gave her comfort after the king died. You were a captive, your father was in the field, and your brother—"
She was afraid of him, and with good reason. He made me betray her. Did he?
Lancel and Sir Osmond, and how many more? Was the part about Moonboy just a jibe?
Did you force her?
No! I loved her. I wanted to protect her. You wanted to be me.
His phantom fingers itched. The day his sister had come to White Sword Tower to beg him to renounce his vows, she had laughed after he refused her and boasted of having lied to him 1,000 times. Jamie had taken that for a clumsy attempt to hurt him, as he'd hurt her. It may have been the only true thing that she ever said to me.
"Do not think ill of the Queen," Lancel pleaded. "All flesh is weak, Jamie. No harm came of our sin. No bastard."
"No. Bastards are seldom made upon the belly." He wondered what his cousin would say if he were to confess his own sins, the 3 treasons Circe had named Joffrey, Tommen, and Myrcella.
"I was angry with Her Grace after the battle, but the High Septon said I must forgive her."
"You confessed your sins to His High Holiness, did you?"
"He prayed for me when I was wounded. He was a good man."
"He's a dead man. They rang the bells for him." He wondered if his cousin had any notion what fruit his words had borne. "Lancel, you're a bloody fool."
"You are not wrong," said Lancel, "but my folly is behind me, sir. I have asked the Father above to show me the way, and he has. I am renouncing this lordship and this wife. Hardstone is welcome to the both of them, if he likes. On the morrow I will return to King's Landing and swear my sword to the new High Septon and the 7. I mean to take vows and join the Warrior's Sons."
The boy was not making sense. The Warrior's Sons were proscribed 300 years ago.
The new High Septon has revived them. He sent out a call for worthy knights to pledge their lives and swords to the service of the 7. The poor fellows are to be restored as well.
Why would the Iron Throne allow that?
One of the early Targaryen kings had fought for years to suppress the 2 military orders, Jaime recalled, though he did not remember which, Maegor, perhaps, or the first Jaehaerys. Tyrion would have known. "His High Holiness writes that King Tommen has given his consent. I will show you the letter if you like."
"Even if this is true, you are a Lion of the Rock, a lord. You have a wife, a castle, lands to defend, people to protect. If the gods are good, you will have sons of your blood to follow you. Why would you throw all that away for some vow?"
"Why did you?" asked Lancel softly. "For honor," Jamie might have said. "For glory."
That would have been a lie, though. Honor and glory had played their parts, but most of it had been for Circe. A laugh escaped his lips. "Is it the High Septon you're running to, or my sweet sister? Pray on that one, cuz. Pray hard."
"Will you pray with me, Jamie?"
He glanced about the sept at the gods. The mother, full of mercy. The father, stern in judgment. The warrior, one hand upon his sword.
The stranger in the shadows, his half-human face concealed beneath a hooded mantle.
"I thought that I was the warrior and Circe was the maid. But all the time she was the stranger, hiding her true face from my gaze." "Pray for me, if you like," he told his cousin. "I've forgotten all the words."
The sparrows were still fluttering about the steps when Jamie stepped back out into the night.
"Thank you," he told them. "I feel ever so much holier now."
He went and found Sir Ilyn and a pair of swords. The castle yard was full of eyes and ears. To escape them, they sought out Dari's Godswood. There were no sparrows there, only trees bare and brooding, their black branches scratching at the sky. A mat of dead leaves crunched beneath their feet.
"Do you see that window, sir?" Jamie used a sword to point. "That was Raymond Dari's bedchamber, where King Robert slept on our return from Winterfell. Ned Stark's daughter had run off after her wolf-savage Joff, you'll recall. My sister wanted the girl to lose a hand. The old penalty for striking one of the Blood Royal. Robert told her she was cruel and mad. They fought for half the night. Well, Circe fought and Robert drank. Past midnight, the queen summoned me inside. The king was passed out snoring on the mirrorish carpet. I asked my sister if she wanted me to carry him to bed. She told me I should carry her to bed and shrugged out of a robe. I took her on Raymond Darry's bed after stepping over Robert. If his grace had woken, I would have killed him there and then. He would not have been the first king to die upon my sword. But you know that story, don't you? He slashed at a tree branch, shearing it in half. As I was fucking her, Circe cried, "I want." I thought that she meant me, but it was the Stark girl that she wanted, maimed or dead. The things I do for love. It was only by chance that Stark's own men found the girl before me. If I had come on her first. The pockmarks on Sir Ilan's face were black holes in the torchlight, as dark as Jamie's soul. He made that clacking sound. "He is laughing at me," realized Jamie Lannister. "For all I know, you fucked my sister too, you pock-faced bastard," he spat out. "Well, shut your bloody mouth and kill me if you can."
John. Ghost was gone when the wildlings led their horses from the cave. Did he understand about Castle Black? John took a breath of the crisp morning air and allowed himself to hope. The eastern sky was pink near the horizon and pale grey higher up. The sword of the morning still hung in the south, the bright white star in its hilt blazing like a diamond in the dawn. But the blacks and greys of the darkling forest were turning once again to greens and golds, reds and russets. And above, the soldier pines and oaks and ash and sentinels stood the wall. The ice, pale and glimmering beneath the dust and dirt that pocked its surface. The Magnar sent a dozen men riding west and a dozen more east to climb the highest hills they could find and watch for any sign of rangers in the wood or riders on the high ice. The Thens carried bronze-banded warhorns to give warning should the watch be sighted. The other wildlings fell in behind Jarl, John, and Ygritte with the rest. This was to be the young raider's hour of glory. The wall was often said to stand 700 feet high, but Jarl had found a place where it was both higher and lower. Before them the ice rose sheer from out of the trees like some immense cliff, crowned by wind-carved battlements that loomed at least 800 feet high, perhaps 900 in spots. But that was deceptive, John realized, as they drew closer. Brandon the Builder had laid his huge foundation blocks along the heights whenever feasible, and hereabouts the hills rose wild and rugged. He'd once heard his uncle Benjen say that the wall was a sword east of Castle Black, but a snake to the west. It was true. Sweeping in over one huge humped hill, the ice dipped down into a valley, climbed the knife edge of a long granite ridgeline for a league or more, ran along a jagged crest, dipped again into a valley deeper still, and then rose higher and higher, leaping from hill to hill as far as the eye could see into the mountainous west. Jarl had chosen to assault the stretch of ice along the ridge. Here, though the top of the wall loomed 800 feet above the forest floor, a good third of that height was earth and stone, rather than ice. The slope was too steep for their horses, almost as difficult to scramble as the fist of the first man, but still vastly easier to ascend than the sheer vertical face of the wall itself. And the ridge was densely wooded as well, offering easy concealment. Once, brothers in black had gone out every day with axes to cut back the encroaching trees, but those days were long past, and here the forest grew right up to the ice. The day promised to be damp and cold, and damper and colder by the wall, beneath those tons of ice. The closer they got, the more the Thens held back. They have never seen the wall before, not even the Magna, John realized. It frightens them. In the Seven Kingdoms, it was said that the wall marked the end of the world. That is true for them as well. It was all in where you stood. And where do I stand? John did not know. To stay with Ygritte, he would need to become a wildling, heart and soul. If he abandoned her to return to his duty, the Magna might cut her heart out. And if he took her with him, assuming she would go, which was far from certain, well, he could scarcely bring her back to Castle Black to live among the brothers. A deserter and a wildling could expect no welcome anywhere in the Seven Kingdoms. We could go look for Gendel's children, I suppose, though they'd be more like to eat us than to take us in. The wall did not awe Jarl's raiders, John saw. They have done this before, every man of them. Jarl called out names when they dismounted, beneath the ridge, and 11 gathered round him. All were young. The oldest could not have been more than 25, and 2 of the 10 were younger than John. Everyone was lean and hard, though. They had a look of sinewy strength that reminded him of Stone Snake, the brother the half-hand had sent off afoot when Rattleshirt was hunting them. In the very shadow of the wall the wildlings made ready, winding thick coils of hempen rope around one shoulder and down across their chests, and lacing on queer boots of supple doeskin. The boots had spikes jutting from the toes, iron for Jarl and 2 others, bronze for some, but most often jagged bone. Small stone-headed hammers hung from one hip, a leathern bag of stakes from the other. Their ice axes were antlers with sharpened tines, bound to wooden hafts with strips of hide. The 11 climbers sorted themselves into 3 teams of 4. Jarl himself made the 12th man. "Mance promises swords for every man of the first team to reach the top," he told them, his breath misting in the cold air. "Southern swords of castle forged steel, and your name in the song he'll make of this, that too. What more could a free man ask? Up, and the others take the hindmost!" The others take them all, thought John, as he watched them scramble up the steep slope of the ridge and vanish beneath the trees. It would not be the first time the wildlings had scaled the wall, not even the 101st. The patrols stumbled on climbers 2 or 3 times a year, and rangers sometimes came on the broken corpses of those who had fallen. Along the east coast, the raiders most often built boats to slip across the Bay of Seals. In the west, they would descend into the black depths of the gorge to make their way around the Shadow Tower, but in between, the only way to defeat the wall was to go over it, and many a raider had. Fewer come back, though, he thought, with a certain grim pride. Climbers must, of necessity, leave their mounts behind, and many younger, greener raiders began by taking the first horses they found. Then a hue and cry would go up, ravens would fly, and as often as not, the Night's Watch would hunt them down and hang them before they could get back with their plunder and stolen women. Jarl would not make that mistake, John knew, but he wondered about Styr. The Magnor is a ruler, not a raider. He may not know how the game is played.
"There they are,"
Ygritte said, and John glanced up to see the first climber emerge above the treetops. It was Jarl. He had found a sentinel tree that leaned against the wall, and led his men up the trunk to get a quicker start. The wood should never have been allowed to creep so close. They're 300 feet up, and they haven't touched the ice itself yet. He watched the wildling move carefully from wood to wall, hacking out a handhold with short, sharp blows of his ice axe, then swinging over. The rope around his waist tied him to the second man in line, still edging up the tree. Step by slow step, Jarl moved higher, kicking out toe holes with his spiked boots when there were no natural ones to be found. When he was 10 feet above the sentinel, he stopped upon a narrow, icy ledge, slung his axe from his belt, took out his hammer, and drove an iron stake into a cleft. The second man moved onto the wall behind him, while the third was scrambling to the top of the tree. The other 2 teams had no happily placed trees to give them a leg up, and before long the Thens were wondering whether they had gotten lost climbing the ridge. Jarl's party were all on the wall and 80 feet up before the leading climbers from the other groups came into view. The teams were spaced a good 20 yards apart. Jarl's 4 were in the centre. To the right of them was a team led by Grig the Goat, whose long blonde braid made him easy to spot from below. To the left, a very thin man named Eric led the climbers.
"So slow,"
the Magnar complained loudly as he watched them edge their way upward.
"Has he forgotten the crews? He should climb faster afore we are discovered."
John had to hold his tongue. He remembered the Skirling Pass all too well, and the moonlight climb he'd made with Stone Snake. He had swallowed his heart a half a dozen times that night, and by the end his arms and legs had been aching and his fingers were half frozen. And that was stone, not ice. Stone was solid. Ice was treacherous stuff at the best of times, and on a day like this, when the wall was weeping, the warmth of a climber's hand might be enough to melt it. The huge blocks could be frozen rock hard inside, but their outer surface would be slick with runnels of water trickling down and patches of rotten ice where the air had gotten in. Whatever else the wildlings are, they're brave. All the same, John found himself hoping that Sturr's fears proved well-founded. If the gods are good, a patrol will chance by and put an end to this. "No wall can keep you safe," his father told him once, as they walked the walls of Winterfell. "A wall is only as strong as the men who defend it. The wildlings might have 120 men, but 4 defenders would be enough to see them off, with a few well-placed arrows and perhaps a pail of stones." No defenders appeared, however. Not 4, not even 1. The sun climbed the sky, and the wildlings climbed the wall. Jarl's 4 remained well ahead till noon, when they hit a patch of bad ice. Jarl had looped his rope around a wind-carved pinnace and was using it to support his weight when the whole jagged thing suddenly crumbled and came crashing down and him with it. Chunks of ice as big as a man's head bombarded the 3 below, but they clung to the handholds and the stakes held, and Jarl jerked to a sudden halt at the end of the rope. By the time his team had recovered from that mischance, Grig the Goat had almost drawn even with them. Eric's 4 remained well behind. The face where they were climbing looked smooth and unpitted, covered with a sheet of ice melt that glistened wetly where the sun brushed it. Grig's section was darker to the eye, with more obvious features, long horizontal ledges where a block had been imperfectly positioned atop the block below, cracks and crevices, even chimneys along the vertical joins, where wind and water had eaten holes large enough for a man to hide in. Jarl soon had his men edging upward again. His 4 and Grig's moved almost side by side, with Eric's 50 feet below. Deerhorn axes chopped and hacked, sending showers of glittery shards cascading down onto the trees. Stone hammers pounded stakes deep into the ice to serve as anchors for the ropes. The iron stakes ran out before they were halfway up, and after that the climbers used horn and sharpened bone. And the men kicked, driving the spikes on their boots against the hard, unyielding ice again and again and again and again to make one foothold. Their legs must be numb, John thought, by the 4th hour. How long can they keep on with that? He watched as restless as the Magna, listening for the distant moan of a thin war horn. But the horn stayed silent, and there was no sign of the night's watch. By the 6th hour, Jarl had moved ahead of Grig the Goat again, and his men were widening the gap.
"The manse's pet must want a sword," the Magna said, shading his eyes.
The sun was high in the sky, and the upper third of the wall was a crystalline blue from below, reflecting so brilliantly that it hurt the eyes to look on it. Jarl's 4 and Grig's were all but lost in the glare, though Eric's team was still in shadow. Instead of moving upward, they were edging their way sideways at about 500 feet, making for a chimney. John was watching them inch along when he heard the sound, a sudden crack that seemed to roll along the ice, followed by a shout of alarm, and then the air was full of shards and shrieks and falling men, as a sheet of ice, a foot thick and 50 feet square, broke off from the wall and came tumbling, crumbling, rumbling, sweeping all before it. Even down at the foot of the ridge, some chunks came spinning through the trees and rolling down the slope. John grabbed Ygritte and pulled her down to shield her, and one of the thens was struck in the face by a chunk that broke his nose.
and when they looked up, Jarl and his team were gone. Men, ropes, stakes, all gone. Nothing remained above 600 feet. There was a wound in the wall where the climbers had clung half a heartbeat before. The ice within as smooth and white as polished marble and shining in the sun. Far, far below, there was a faint red smear where someone had smashed against a frozen pinnace. The wall defends itself, John thought, as he pulled Ygritte back to her feet. They found Jarl in a tree, impaled upon a splintered branch, and still roped to the three men who lay broken beneath him. One was still alive, but his legs and spine were shattered, and most of his ribs as well.
"Mercy!"
he said when they came upon him. One of the Thens smashed his head in with a big stone mace. The Magna gave orders, and his men began to gather fuel for a pyre. The dead were burning when Grig the Goat reached the top of the wall. By the time Eric's four had joined them, nothing remained of Jarl and his team but bone and ash. The sun had begun to sink by then, so the climbers wasted little time. They unwound the long coils of hemp they had looped around their chests, tied them all together, and tossed down one end. The thought of trying to climb 500 feet up that rope filled John with dread, but Mance had planned better than that. The raiders Jarl had left below uncast a huge ladder with rungs of woven hemp as thick as a man's arm and tied it to the climber's rope. Eric and Grig and their men grunted and heaved, pulled it up, staked it to the top, then lowered the rope again and hauled up a second ladder. There were five altogether. When all of them were in place, the Magnor shouted a brusque command in the old tongue, and five of his Thens started up together. Even with the ladders, it was no easy climb. Ygritte watched them struggle for a while. "I hate this wall," she said in a low, angry voice. "Can you feel how cold it is?" "It's made of ice," John pointed out. "You know nothing, Jon Snow. This wall is made of blood." Nor had it drunk its fill. By sunset, two of the Thens had fallen from the ladder to their deaths, but they were the last. It was near midnight before John reached the top. The stars were out again, and Ygritte was trembling from the climb.
"I almost fell," she said with tears in her eyes. "Twice, thrice. The wall was trying to shake me off. I could feel it."
One of the tears broke free and trickled down her cheek. "The worst is behind us," John tried to sound confident. "Don't be frightened." He tried to put an arm around her. Ygritte slammed the heel of her hand into his chest, so hard it stung even through his layers of wool, mail, and boiled leather.
"I wasn't frightened. You know nothing, Jon Snow."
"Why are you crying, then?"
"Not for fear."
She kicked savagely at the ice beneath her with a heel, chopping out a chunk.
"I'm crying because we never found the Horn of Winter. We opened 50 graves and let all those shades loose in the world, and never found the Horn of Joriman to bring this cold thing down."
Brain. The Sceptre stood upon an upthrust island half a mile from the shore, where the wide mouth of the Trident widened further still to kiss the Bay of Crabs. Even from shore its prosperity was apparent. Its slope was covered with terraced fields, with fish ponds down below and a windmill above, its wood and sailcloth blades turning slowly in the breeze off the bay. Brain could see sheep grazing on the hillside and storks wading in the shallow waters around the ferry landing. "Salt Pans is just across the water," said Septon Meribald, pointing north across the bay. "The brothers will ferry us over on the morning tide, though I fear what we shall find there. Let us enjoy a good hot meal before we face that. The brothers always have a bone to spare for Dog." Dog barked and wagged his tail. The tide was going out now, and swiftly. The water that separated the island from the shore was receding, leaving behind a broad expanse of glistening brown mudflats dotted by tidal pools that glittered like golden coins in the afternoon sun. Brain scratched the back of her neck where an insect had bitten her. She had pinned her hair up and the sun had warmed her skin. "Why do they call it the Quiet Isle?" asked Podrick. "Those who dwell here are penitents who seek to atone for their sins through contemplation, prayer, and silence. Only the elder brother and his proctors are permitted to speak, and the proctors only for one day of every seven."
"The silent sisters never speak," said Podrick. "I heard they don't have any tongues."
Septon Meribald smiled. "Mothers have been cowing their daughters with that tale since I was your age. There was no truth to it then, and there is none now. A vow of silence is an act of contrition, a sacrifice by which we prove our devotion to the seven above. For a mute to take a vow of silence would be akin to a legless man giving up the dance." He led his donkey down the slope, beckoning them to follow. "If you would sleep beneath a roof tonight, you must climb off your horses and cross the mud with me. The path of faith, we call it. Only the faithful may cross safely. The wicked are swallowed by the quicksands or drowned when the tide comes rushing in. None of you are wicked, I hope. Even so, I would be careful where I set my feet. Walk only where I walk, and you shall reach the other side." The path of faith was a crooked one. Rain could not help but note. Though the island seemed to rise to the northeast of where they left the shore, Septon Meribald did not make directly for it. Instead, he started due east, toward the deeper waters of the bay, which shimmered blue and silver in the distance. The soft brown mud squished up between his toes. As he walked, he paused from time to time to probe ahead with his quarterstaff. Dog stayed near his heels, sniffing at every rock, shell, and clump of seaweed. For once, he did not bound ahead or stray. Brain followed, taking care to keep close to the line of prints left by the dog, the donkey, and the holy man. Then came Podrick, and last of all, Sir Hyle. 100 yards out, Meribald turned abruptly toward the south, so his back was almost to the septuary. He proceeded in that direction for another 100 yards, leading them between two shallow tidal pools. Dog stuck his nose in one and yelped when a crab pinched it with his claw. A brief but furious struggle ensued before the dog came trotting back, wet and mud-spattered, with the crab between his jaws. "Isn't that where we want to go?" Sir Hyle called out from behind them, pointing at the septuary. "We seem to be walking every way but toward it."
"Faith," urged Septon Meribald. "Believe, persist, and follow, and we shall find the peace we seek."
The flats shimmered wetly all about them, mottled in 50 hues. The mud was such a dark brown it appeared almost black, but there were swathes of golden sand as well, upthrust rocks, both grey and red, and tangles of black and green seaweed. Storks stalked through the tidal pools and left their footprints all around them, and crabs scuttled across the surface of shallow waters. The air smelled of brine and rot, and the ground sucked at their feet and let them go only reluctantly with a pop and a squelchy sigh. Septon Meribald turned and turned again and yet again. His footprints filled up with water as soon as he moved on. By the time the ground grew firmer and began to rise beneath the feet, they had walked at least a mile and a half. 3 men were waiting for them as they clambered up the broken stones that ringed the isle's shoreline. They were clad in the brown and dun robes of brothers, with wide bell sleeves and pointed cowls. 2 had wound lengths of wool about the lower halves of their faces as well, so all that could be seen of them were their eyes. The 3rd brother was the one to speak.
"Septon Meribald," he called, "it has been nigh upon a year. You are welcome. Your companions as well."
Dog wagged his tail, and Meribald shook mud from his feet.
"Might we beg your hospitality for a night?"
"Yes, of course. There's to be fish stew this evening. Will you require the ferry in the morning?"
"If it is not too much to ask."
Meribald turned to his fellow travellers.
"Brother Narbert is a proctor of the order, so he is allowed to speak one day of every 7. Brother, these good folk helped me on my way. Sir Hyle Hunt is a gallant from the Reach. The lad is Podrick Payne, late of the Westerland, and this is Lady Brain, known as the Maid of Tarth."
Brother Narbert drew up short.
"A woman?"
"Yes, brother." Brain unpinned her hair and shook it out. Do you have no women here? Not at present, said Narbut. Those women who do visit come to us sick or hurt or heavy with child. The seven have blessed our elder brother with healing hands. He has restored many a man to health that even the maesters could not cure, and many a woman, too. I am not sick or hurt or heavy with child. Lady Brahein is a warrior maid, confided Septon Meribald, hunting for the hound. Aye, Narbut seemed taken aback. To what end? Brahein touched Oathkeeper's hilt. His, she said. The proctor studied her. You are brawny for a woman, it is true, but mayhaps I should take you up to Elder Brother. He will have seen you crossing the mud. Come. Narbut led them along a pebbled path and through a grove of apple trees to a whitewashed stable with a peaked thatch roof. You may leave your animals here. Brother Gillam will see that they are fed and watered. The stable was more than three quarters empty. At one end were half a dozen mules being tended by a bandy-legged little brother, whom Brahein took for Gillam. Way down at the far end, well away from the other animals, a huge black stallion trumpeted at the sound of their voices and kicked at the door of his stall. Sir Hyle gave the big horse an admiring look as he was handing his reins to Brother Gillam. A handsome beast. Brother Narbut sighed. The seven send us blessings, and the seven send us trials. Handsome he may be, but Driftwood was surely whelped in hell. When we sought to harness him to a plough, he kicked Brother Rawney and broke his shinbone in two places. We had hoped gelding might improve the beast's ill temper, but... Brother Gillam, will you show them? Brother Gillam lowered his cowl. Underneath he had a mop of blonde hair, a tonsured scalp, and a blood-stained bandage where he should have had an ear. Podrick gasped. The horse bit off your ear. Gillam nodded and covered his head again. Forgive me, brother, said Sir Hyle, but I might take the other ear if you approached me with a pair of shears. The jest did not sit well with Brother Narbut. You are a knight, sir. Driftwood is a beast of burden. The smith gave men horses to help them in their labours. He turned away. If you will, elder brother will no doubt be waiting. The slope was steeper than it had looked from across the mudflats. To ease it, the brothers had erected a flight of wooden steps that wandered back and forth across the hillside and amongst the buildings. After a long day in the saddle, Brahein was glad for a chance to stretch her legs. They passed a dozen brothers of the order on their way up, cowled men in dun and brown, who gave them curious looks as they went by, but spoke no word of greeting. One was leading a pair of milk cows toward a low barn roofed in sod. Another worked a butter churn. On the upper slopes they saw three boys driving sheep, and higher still they passed a lich yard, where a brother bigger than Brahein was struggling to dig a grave. From the way he moved, it was plain to see that he was lame. As he flung a spadeful of the stony soil over one shoulder, some chanced to spatter against their feet. "Be more watchful there," chided Brother Narbut. "Septon Meribald might have gotten a mouthful of dirt." The gravedigger lowered his head. When Dog went to sniff him, he dropped his spade and scratched his ear. "A novice," explained Narbut. "Who is the grave for?" asked Sir Hyle as they resumed their climb up the wooden steps. "Brother Clement, may the father judge him justly." "Was he old?" asked Podrick Payne. "If you consider 48 old, aye, but it was not the years that killed him. He died of wounds he got at Salt Pans. He had taken some of our mead to the market there on the day the outlaws descended on the town." "The hound," said Brahein. "Another just as brutal. He cut poor Clement's tongue out when he would not speak. Since he had taken a vow of silence, the raider said he had no need of it. The elder brother will know more. He keeps the worst of the tidings from outside to himself, so as not to disturb the tranquillity of the septry. Many of our brothers came here to escape the horrors of the world, not to dwell upon them. Brother Clement was not the only wounded man amongst us. Some wounds do not show." Brother Narbut gestured to their right. "There lies our summer arbor. The grapes are small and tart, but make a drinkable wine. We brew our own ale as well, and our mead and cider are far famed. The war has never come here, Brain said. Not this war, praise the Seven. Our prayers protect us. And your tides, suggested Meribald. Dog barked agreement. The brow of the hill was crowned by a low wall of unmortared stone encircling a cluster of large buildings. The windmill, its sails creaking as they turned, the cloisters where the brothers slept, and the common hall where they took their meals, a wooden sept for prayer and meditation. The sept had windows of leaded glass, wide doors carved with likenesses of the mother and the father, and a seven-sided steeple with a walk on top. Behind it was a vegetable garden where some older brothers were pulling weeds. Brother Narbert led the visitors around a chestnut tree to a wooden door set in the side of the hill. A cave with a door, Sir Hyle said, surprised. Septon Meribald smiled. It is called the Hermit's Hole. The first holy man to find his way here lived therein, and worked such wonders that others came to join him. That was 2,000 years ago, they say. The door came somewhat later. Perhaps 2,000 years ago the hermit's hole had been a damp, dark place, floored with dirt and echoing to the sounds of dripping water, but no longer. The cave that Brain and her companions entered had been turned into a warm, snug sanctum. Woolen carpets covered the ground, tapestries the walls. Tall beeswax candles gave more than ample light. The furnishings were strange but simple. A long table, a settle, a chest, several tall cases full of books and chairs. All were made from driftwood, oddly shaped pieces, cunningly joined together and polished till they shone a deep gold in the candlelight. The elder brother was not what Brain had expected. He could hardly be called elder, for a start, whereas the brothers weeding in the garden had had the stooped shoulders and bent backs of old men. He stood straight and tall, and moved with the vigour of a man in the prime of his years. Nor did he have the gentle, kindly face she expected of a healer. His head was large and square, his eyes shrewd, his nose veined and red. Though he wore a tonsure, his scalp was as stubbly as his heavy jaw. He looks more like a man made to break bones than to heal one, thought the maid of Tarth, as the elder brother strode across the room to embrace Septon Meribald and pat Dog. It is always a glad day when our friends Meribald and Dog honour us with another visit, he announced, before turning to his other guests. And new faces are always welcome. We see so few of them. Meribald performed the customary courtesies before seating himself upon the settle. Unlike Septon Narbert, the elder brother did not seem dismayed by Brain's sex, but his smile did flicker and fade when the Septon told him why she and Sir Hyle had come. "I see," was all he said, before he turned away with, "You must be thirsty. Please, have some of our sweet cider to wash the dust of travel from your throats." He poured for them himself. The cups were carved from driftwood too, no two the same. When Brain complimented them, he said, "My lady is too kind. All we do is cut and polish the wood. We are blessed here. Where the river meets the bay, the currents and the tides wrestle one against the other, and many strange and wondrous things are pushed toward us to wash up on our shores. Driftwood is the least of it. We have found silver cups and iron pots, sacks of wool and bolts of silk, rusted helms and shining swords, aye, and rubies." That interested Sir Hyle. "Rhaegar's rubies? It may be, who can say? The battle was long leagues from here, but the river is tireless and patient. Six have been found. We are all waiting for the seventh." "Better rubies than bones." Septon Meribald was rubbing his foot, the mud flaking off beneath his finger. "Not all the river's gifts are pleasant. The good brothers collect the dead as well. Drowned cows, drowned deer, dead pigs, swollen up to half the size of horses. Aye, and corpses." "Too many corpses these days," the elder brother sighed. "Our grave digger knows no rest. Rivermen, westermen, northmen, all wash up here, knights and knaves alike. We bury them side by side, Stark and Lannister, Blackwood and Bracken, Frey and Darry.
That is the duty the river asks of us in return for all its gifts, and we do it as best we can. Sometimes we find a woman, though, or worse, a little child. Those are the cruelest gifts. He turned to Septon Meribald. I hope that you have time to absolve us of our sins. Since the raiders slew old Septon Bennett, we have had no one to hear confession.
I shall make time, said Meribald, though I hope you have some better sins than the last time I came through.
Dog barked. You see, even Dog was bored.
Podrick Payne was puzzled. I thought no one could talk. Well, not no one. The brothers?
The other brothers, not you.
We are allowed to break silence when confessing, said the elder brother. It is hard to speak of sin with signs and nods.
Did they burn the sept at Saltpans? Asked Heilhunt.
The smile vanished.
They burned everything at Saltpans, save the castle. Only that was made of stone, though it had as well been made of suet for all the good it did the town. It fell to me to treat some of the survivors. The fisherfolk brought them across the bay to me after the flames had gone out, and they deemed it safe to land. One poor woman had been raped a dozen times, and her breasts. My lady, you wear man's mail, so I shall not spare you these horrors. Her breasts had been torn and chewed and eaten, as if by some cruel beast. I did what I could for her, though that was little enough. As she lay dying, her worst curses were not for the men who had raped her, nor the monster who devoured her living flesh, but for Sir Quincy Cox, who barred his gates when the outlaws entered the town and sat safe behind the stone walls as his people screamed and died.
"Sir Quincy is an old man," said Septon Meribald gently. "His sons and good sons are far away or dead. His grandsons are still boys, and he has two daughters. What could he have done, one man, against so many?"
"He could have tried." Brain thought. He could have died. Old or young, a true knight is sworn to protect those who are weaker than himself, or die in the attempt.
True words and wise, the elder brother said to Septon Meribald. When you cross to Saltpans, no doubt Sir Quincy will ask you for forgiveness. I am glad that you are here to give it. I could not.
He put aside the driftwood cup and stood. The supper bell will sound soon. My friends, will you come with me to the sept to pray for the souls of the good folk of Saltpans before we sit down to break bread and share some meat and mead?
Gladly, said Meribald.
Dog barked. Their supper in the septory was as strange a meal as Brain had ever eaten, though not at all unpleasant. The food was plain but very good. There were loaves of crusty bread still warm from the ovens, crocks of fresh-churned butter, honey from the septory's hives, and a thick stew of crabs, mussels, and at least three different kinds of fish. Septon Meribald and Sir Hyle drank the mead the brothers made, and pronounced it excellent, whilst she and Podrick contented themselves with more sweet cider. Nor was the meal a sombre one. Meribald pronounced a prayer before the food was served, and whilst the brothers ate at four long trestle tables, one of their number played for them on the high harp, filling the hall with soft, sweet sounds. When the elder brother excused the musician to take his own meal, Brother Narbot and another proctor took turns reading from the seven-pointed star. By the time the readings were completed, the last of the food had been cleared away by the novices whose task it was to serve. Most were boys near Podrick's age or younger, but there were grown men as well, amongst them the big gravedigger they had encountered on the hill, who walked with the awkward lurching gait of one half-crippled. As the hall emptied, the elder brother asked Narbot to show Podrick and Sir Hyle to their pallets in the cloisters.
"You will not mind sharing a cell, I hope. It is not large, but you will find it comfortable."
"I want to stay with Sir," said Podrick. "I mean, my lady."
"What you and Lady Brian may do elsewhere is between you and the seven," said Brother Narbot. "But on the quiet isle, men and women do not sleep beneath the same roof unless they are wed."
"We have some modest cottages set aside for the women who visit us, be they noble ladies or common village girls," said the elder brother. "They are not oft used, but we keep them clean and dry. Lady Brain, would you allow me to show you the way?"
"Yes, thank you.
Podrick, go with Sir Hyle. We are guests of the Holy Brothers here. Beneath their roof, their rules. The women's cottages were on the east side of the isle, looking out over a broad expanse of mud and the distant waters of the Bay of Crabs. It was colder here than on the sheltered side, and wilder. The hill was steeper, and the path meandered back and forth through weeds and briars, wind-carved rocks, and twisted thorny trees that clung tenaciously to the stony hillside. The elder brother brought a lantern to light their way down. At one turn, he paused. On a clear night, you could see the fires of salt pans from here. Across the bay, just there, he pointed. There's nothing, Brian said. Only the castle remains. Even the fisherfolk are gone, the fortunate few who were out on the water when the raiders came. They watch their houses burn and listen to screams and cries float across the harbour, too fearful to land their boats. When at last they came ashore, it was to bury friends and kin. What is there for them at Salt Pans now but bones and bitter memories? They have moved to Maidenpool or other towns. He gestured with the lantern, and they resumed their descent. Salt Pans was never an important port, but ships did call there from time to time. That was what the raiders wanted, a galley or a cog to carry them across the narrow sea. When none was at hand, they took their rage and desperation out upon the townsfolk. I wonder, my lady, what do you hope to find there?
A girl, she told him, a high-born maid of 3 and 10 with a fair face and auburn hair.
Sansa Stark. The name was softly said. You believe this poor child is with the Hound?
The Dornishman said that she was on her way to Riverrun. Timian. He was a sellsword, one of the brave companions, a killer and a raper and a liar. But I do not think he lied about this. He said that the Hound stole her and carried her away.
I see.
The path turned, and there were the cottages ahead of them. The elder brother had called them modest. That they were. They looked like beehives made of stone, low and rounded, windowless.
This one, he said, indicating the nearest cottage, the only one with smoke rising from the smoke hole in the centre of its roof.
Brain had to duck when entering to keep from banging her head against the lintel. Inside she found a dirt floor, a straw pallet, furs and blankets to keep her warm, a basin of water, a flagon of cider, some bread and cheese, a small fire, and 2 low chairs. The elder brother sat in one and put the lantern down.
May I stay a while? I feel that we should talk.
If you wish. Brain undid her sword belt and hung it from the second chair, then sat cross-legged on the pallet.
Your Dornishman did not lie, the elder brother began, but I fear you did not understand him.
You are chasing the wrong wolf, my lady. Eddard Stark had 2 daughters. It was the other one that Sandor Clegane made off with, the younger one.
Arya Stark?
Brain stared open-mouthed, astonished.
You know this. Lady Sansa's sister is alive.
Then, said the elder brother, now, I do not know. She may have been amongst the children slain at Salt Pans. The words were a knife in her belly.
No, Brain thought. No, that would be too cruel.
May have been, meaning that you are not certain. I am certain that the child was with Sandor Clegane at the inn beside the crossroads, the one old Masha Heddle used to keep before the lions hanged her. I am certain they were on their way to Salt Pans. Beyond that, no. I do not know where she is, or even if she lives. There is one thing I do know, however. The man you hunt is dead. That was another shock.
How did he die?
By the sword, as he had lived.
You know this for a certainty.
I buried him myself. I can tell you where his grave lies, if you wish. I covered him with stones to keep the carrion eaters from digging up his flesh, and set his helm atop the cairn to mark his final resting place. That was a grievous error. Some other wayfarer found my marker and claimed it for himself. The man who raped and killed at Salt Pans was not Sandor Clegane, though he may be as dangerous. The Riverlands are full of such scavengers. I will not call them wolves. Wolves are nobler than that, and so are dogs, I think. I know a little of this man, Sandor Clegane.
He was Prince Joffrey's sworn shield for many a year, and even here we would hear tell of his deeds, both good and ill. If even half of what we heard was true, this was a bitter, tormented soul, a sinner who mocked both gods and men. He served, but found no pride in service. He fought, but took no joy in victory. He drank to drown his pain in a sea of wine. He did not love, nor was he loved himself. It was hate that drove him. Though he committed many sins, he never sought forgiveness. Where other men dream of love, or wealth, or glory, this man Sandor Clegane dreamed of slaying his own brother, a sin so terrible it makes me shudder just to speak of it. Yet that was the bread that nourished him, the fuel that kept his fires burning. Ignoble as it was, the hope of seeing his brother's blood upon his blade was all this sad and angry creature lived for, and even that was taken from him when Prince Oberyn of Dorne stabbed Sir Gregor with a poisoned spear.
"You sound as if you pity him," said Brian.
"I did. You would have pitied him as well if you had seen him at the end. I came upon him by the trident, drawn by his cries of pain. He begged me for the gift of mercy, but I am sworn not to kill again. Instead, I bathed his fevered brow with river water, and gave him wine to drink and a poultice for his wound. But my efforts were too little and too late. The hound died there in my arms. You may have seen a big black stallion in our stables. That was his warhorse, Stranger, a blasphemous name. We prefer to call him Driftwood, as he was found beside the river. I fear he has his former master's nature. The horse. She had seen the stallion, had heard it kicking, but she had not understood. Destriers were trained to kick and bite. In war they were a weapon, like the men who rode them, like the hound. It is true, then, she said dully. Sandor Clegane is dead. He is at rest. The elder brother paused. You are young, child. I have counted 44 name days, which makes me more than twice your age, I think. Would it surprise you to learn that I was once a knight? No, you look more like a knight than you do a holy man. It was written in his chest and shoulders and across that thick, square jaw. Why would you give up knighthood? I never chose it. My father was a knight and his before him. So were my brothers, everyone. I was trained for battle since the day they deemed me old enough to hold a wooden sword. I saw my share of them and did not disgrace myself. I had women, too, and there I did disgrace myself. For some I took by force. There was a girl I wished to marry, the younger daughter of a petty lord. But I was my father's third-born son and had neither land nor wealth to offer her. Only a sword, a horse, a shield. All in all, I was a sad man. When I was not fighting, I was drunk. My life was written red in blood and wine.
When did it change?
Asked Brain. When I died in the Battle of the Trident. I fought for Prince Rhaegar, though he never knew my name. I could not tell you why, save that the lord I served a lord who served a lord who had decided to support the dragon rather than the stag. Had he decided elsewise, I might have been on the other side of the river. The battle was a bloody thing. The singers would have us believe it was all Rhaegar and Robert struggling in the stream for a woman both of them claimed to love. But I assure you, other men were fighting too, and I was one. I took an arrow through the thigh and another through the foot, and my horse was killed from under me, yet I fought on. I can still remember how desperate I was to find another horse, for I had no coin to buy one, and without a horse, I would no longer be a knight. That was all that I was thinking of, truth be told. I never saw the blow that felled me. I heard hooves behind my back and thought, a horse? But before I could turn, something slammed into my head and knocked me back into the river, where by rights I should have drowned. Instead, I woke here upon the quiet isle. The elder brother told me I had washed up on the tide, naked as my name day. I can only think that someone found me in the shallows, stripped me of my armor, boots, and breeches, and pushed me back out into the deeper water. The river did the rest.
We are all born naked, so I suppose it was only fitting that I come into my second life the same way. I spent the next 10 years in silence. I see. Brain did not know why he was telling her all of this.